This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, living under occupied military rule. We are going to start today, though, with when the rules are unfair for you. Well, sometimes you have to strike out on your own. That's similar to what was happening to North Dakotans back in the early 20th century when they were getting ripped off by big banks in Minneapolis and even New York City. And so they started their own. Prairie Public intern Nick Rommel explores the legacy of the State Bank of North Dakota in supporting small banks and the communities they serve.
North Dakota, 1913. A.C. Townley is a down-on-his-luck flax farmer from Beach who has just lost everything. He's always been for the common man, so he takes to crisscrossing the state in a Model T Ford, stirring up farmers against the exorbitant credit, railroad, and milling rates charged by big out-of-state corporations. And no representation for the farmer in Bismarck to fight it. "Well, I'll do it, by God," he said, with a new political party, the Nonpartisan League. And after a few more years of ragtag crusading, the NPL swept to power in 1918. 1 year later, the Bank of North Dakota was signed into existence. It got $2 million in starting funds and started lending at lower rates to farmers that had been taken for a ride by the Minneapolis banks for too long. North Dakota's unique banking history was born. At the same time, the state was dotted with community banks. They typically had just one branch and had much smaller means, but the bankers knew all the local farmers and businessmen they lent to and were welcomed warmly by their small communities. One such community, Hankinson, got a new bank in 1935. The Richland County Farmer Globe reported that 2,300 people swarmed the streets of Hankinson for the occasion, where they enjoyed a speech by acting Governor Walter Welford, a performance by the Hankinson Band, and refreshments in the form of ice cream, sandwiches, and beer. Today, the NPL has been rolled into the Democratic Party, and Hankinson's population has declined from its early 1900s high. But the Lincoln State Bank in Hankinson is still there, as is the Bank of North Dakota. And they have more to do with one another than you may think. But first, some modern-day context.
Across the country, we've seen consolidation of banking.
That's Barry Haugen, president of the Independent Community Banks of North Dakota, or ICBND, a trade association for community banks.
And in a number of cases, it's larger banks acquiring smaller community banks, or community banks acquiring other community banks. We're certainly seeing that in North Dakota, but to a lesser extent than we've seen it at the national level or even compared to adjoining states to North Dakota. And I do think in large part that is because of the Bank of North Dakota.
President Haugen is referring to the remarkable lack of consolidation that persists in North Dakota. In fact, almost half of all deposits in North Dakota are with banks that have under $500 million in assets. Those are small banks. For reference, Wells Fargo has $1.8 trillion in assets, 3,600 times more. Only Kansas and Iowa rank higher than us in this regard. But what does the Bank of North Dakota have to do with this? And why is it so important to have community banks in the first place? To begin answering those questions, let's start by talking to Bank of North Dakota President Todd Steinwand.
You know, we're really a banker's bank, and we are truly a partner with the local community banks. And that's really our what we call our secret sauce for the reason why we've been around for 103 years.
This is how it works. All state governments deposit their money in a bank account, just like anybody else. But in North Dakota, that bank account is with the Bank of North Dakota, not some big private bank like your U.S. banks or Wells Fargo. Those banks could send our state's money wherever they want, but the BND doesn't because it has a clearly defined mission.
Well, our mission for the last 103 years, it hasn't changed. It's to promote agriculture, commerce, and industry in North Dakota.
So first of all, almost all the money stays within North Dakota. But how does the BND decide where to invest it and who exactly to lend to? That's where the community banks come in.
Our delivery channel is always through the local financial institutions.
At its simplest, it looks like this. You're a farmer who needs a $7 million loan to expand your farm. You go to your local community bank, but it's a small bank and it has a legal lending limit of $4 million. Well, your bank can get in touch with a BND and involve them in a loan participation.
That happens all the time. That's a very big part of our business, just doing loan participations.
This means the BND will provide the remaining $3 million and you'll repay them both. Notice that it was the small bank that came to the BND asking for a loan participation. This is how it always works. The local bank initiates everything. This may sound pretty ordinary, but what the BND is really doing is making vital investments less risky for small community banks. And that makes a huge difference.
We like to think that we're one of the key factors for having the number of community banks across the state that there is.
There are many community banks across the state. Often named after the towns and counties that they're in, they're a ubiquitous presence on main streets from the Red River Valley to the Badlands. One of them is Lincoln State Bank in Hankinson. Remember with the 1935 grand opening? Today it sits between the railroad tracks and the town grocery store, with branches in neighboring Windmere and Lidgerwood and total assets of $106 million, it's one of North Dakota's smallest banks. I talked to its president and CEO, Bob Worrell, about the BND programs that his bank uses beyond the simple loan participations.
We've utilized both commercial and ag programs for a number of years with Bank of North Dakota. The beginning entrepreneur guarantee program, the local bank funds the loan, but there's a guarantee. If that business fails in the first 5 years, 75% of the unpaid balance would be paid to us from the Bank of North Dakota.
Without the BND there, Bob would be more hesitant to make that loan. If the entrepreneur failed, it would be a big blow to a small bank like his. And as a result, entrepreneurial Hankinsonians would have a harder time funding their ideas. The BND helps community banks reduce risk like that on the ag side as well.
They have beginning farmer loan programs for both on to buy real estate, to buy farmland.
Evan Markisted, an ag loan officer at Ramsey National Bank in Devil's Lake, has seen a lot of those beginning farmers come through his doors.
I think that's where we've seen BND usage the most is on the younger farmers, because typically a younger farmer, you're just getting into the business. Typically the conventional financing, your down payment's anywhere from 30 to 35% cash down. So that's where Bank of North Dakota does come in. They can get the younger farmers into a real estate purchase for 5%, 10% down.
And Ramsey National Bank President Scott Thompson explained how the BND helped the Devil's Lake housing market.
Various programs have been utilized for housing, for rental properties that I don't think we would have been able to construct those projects in a community, because the construction costs versus the rent that you're able to charge don't necessarily correlate perfectly. So that definitely has had an impact on the number of rental units available in Devil's Lake by utilizing like the Flex Pace program to buy the interest rates down.
Scott is referring to another BND financing tool, interest rate buy-downs. Say a real estate developer faces a 5% interest rate on their loan from Ramsey. The local bank can get the BND and the tax dollars of the city of Devil's Lake to pay for most of that interest, buying it down to a very low 1%. The BND gets repaid over a longer time by the developer. The same program was used back in Hankinson when the town hardware store burned down.
We went through Lincoln State Bank to help us, and we ended up using one of the Bank of North Dakota loans for that. I think it was a PACE loan, they call it, an interest buy-down loan.
That's Tim Post of Post's Hardware in Hankinson.
So we got a really, really good interest rate when we rebuilt the store. This is a lot bigger space. We have about 10,000 square feet here now. Before we had right around 5,000. So we doubled the square footage of it.
You get the point. Beginning farmers just starting out, small town hardware stores recovering after a fire. These are risky investments for a small bank, but they're clearly vital for communities, so the BND helps to make it happen. But what if there was no BND? After all, other states have beginning farmers and burned down hardware stores too. They stay afloat somehow. This is where we come back to BND President Todd Steinwand's quote.
We like to think that we're one of the key factors for having the number of community banks across the state that there is.
Most states have fewer community banks than us, and they don't have a BND. When they want to invest in a beginning farmer or a low-rent condo development, they might have to turn to a larger private bank for help. So that $7 million farm loan from before, the extra $3 million that the community bank needs could come from Wells Fargo instead of the BND. But this creates some problems for community banks, like in Hankinson.
We would be hesitant to send all that customer information to, for an example, a larger institution that's in Wahpeton, because then all of a sudden they have all that customer information. And if they're a larger financial institution that could meet that customer's need without us, mm-hmm. all of a sudden they're marketing to that person and we have potentially have lost that customer.
That's one thing. And then there are the programs the BND offers that large private institutions usually just wouldn't. Programs that reflect the BND's public service mission.
Promote agriculture, commerce, and industry in North Dakota.
Relief during natural disasters and events like the COVID pandemic are an example of this.
Prices were below average in 2015. We experienced late season dryness. Yields were substantially reduced across the 2, 3, 4 county region. BND came out with that disaster program immediately in the fall of 15. Yes. There was multiple banks, Ramsey, all kinds of other banks. Real estate loans, machinery loans were lumped together. They used the BND program to stretch those terms out to help people get into the 16 and 17 growing seasons.
Just a heads up, we had some sound quality issues with the following clip, but thought it would still be important to include.
The Bank of North Dakota did an excellent job of being a liaison between the SBA and the small community banks.
That's Brad Streifel, president of Liberty State Bank in Powers Lake. He's talking about the federal government's Small Business Administration and its relief loans to businesses during COVID shutdowns.
Putting on webinars and FaceTime calls to get everybody kind of in line and educated on the best way to do that. And they've kind of stuck a little bit with that model, realizing that that was a value to banks. Now they're still doing webinars monthly on different topics, ag-related topics. They'll get NDSU extension in, IT-related topics. We had one on cryptocurrency. So they're also providing some education opportunities for the small banks where maybe a larger bank has a department that can do that research themselves.
Sentimental hogwash. I claim this institution is not necessary to this town. Therefore, Mr. Chairman, I make a motion to dissolve this institution and turn its assets and liabilities over to the receiver.
It's a Wonderful Life. Old movie, but it's pretty relevant here. We're about to get into the philosophical stuff. Why it's important to even have community banks in the first place.
Joe, you had one of those Potter houses, didn't you? Well, have you forgotten? Have you forgotten what he charged you for that broken-down shack? Here, Ed, you know, you remember last year when things weren't going so well and you couldn't make your payments? Well, you didn't lose your house, did you? You think Potter would have let you keep it? Can't you understand what's happening here?
I claim this institution is not necessary to this town, says Potter, the wealthy magnate trying to close down the credit union in the movie. And maybe he has a point. If these small community banks need help from the BND to do their work, why not just let big banks take over? They have money for any loan that crosses their desks. George Bailey, the protagonist and a banker at the credit union, gave an answer right in the movie.
Here, Ed, you know, you remember last year when things weren't going so well and you couldn't make your payments? Well, you didn't lose your house, did you? You think Potter would have let you keep it?
The thing is, community banks just don't quite operate the way that big business does. Everybody that I talked to said something along these lines.
Some of the loans we have, the profitability wouldn't be there for the large banks to be interested in doing that.
I don't want to speak ill of any large organizations, but community banks historically have been pretty flexible.
You look at any small youth softball league, you know, normally the t-shirts have one of the local financial institutions' name on it.
For an illuminating example, let's go back to Lincoln State Bank in Hankinson in Richland County. I give to you Bob Wuerl.
A number of years ago, we had a new outside director come on, going through some of the new loans, and there was a loan to a cafe. And he had worked for larger financial institutions in his past, but and said, oh, you make cafe loans, you know, or we make cafe loans, and, you know, and kind of the my response was, yes, when you're the only financial institution or you're the only bank in town and the community needs a cafe, you make the loan. Now you try and mitigate the risk to the bank as much as you can.
I imagine like supporting a successful cafe in town means there's one more business that's going to lend from you in the future too. So
exactly. That initial cafe loan turned into probably three more loans over the years as they made improvements to the property. The more successful that customer is, the more successful the bank is going to be. And if we're doing something, that if we're not serving the needs of the community, those deposits aren't going to be there to turn around and re-lend out, or we're not going to have the loan demand. I think large financial institutions have branches in a lot of smaller areas, probably not in a community as small as ours, but to collect deposits from people, and they can maybe they're paying a little higher rate to attract those deposits, but they're funding loans in Chicago or San Francisco or New York with the money that they're gathering from these smaller areas. If the committee or the person that's overseeing lending is sitting 100 or 1,000 miles away, and that loan application for $60,000 comes in for a cafe, it's like, well, doesn't meet all the criteria. We don't do cafe loans. They don't live in that community. It doesn't make any difference to them whether they made the loan or not.
Not sure that there's a better way to put it than Bob just did. North Dakota's community banks are vital in what started 100 years ago as an experiment by an upstart political party commonly slandered as socialists has become a steady, sustainable partner for them. The BND is very profitable. It's used these profits to expand its own operations as well as contribute to the state's budget during economic recessions, and at least 9 other states have explored creating their own state-owned banks. Massachusetts even commissioned a study that found, quote, "The existence of BND likely enhances the viability of small banks in North Dakota."
Profitability is important to us because that's why we can keep operating, why we've been around 100 years, because we are profitable, but that's not what drives us. What drives us is how do we help make North Dakota better. To me, is the biggest impact we have is the fact that we are partnering with those local banks providing, you know, credit to the Main Street businesses, small businesses, and then they in turn employ, you know, have employees and all those sorts of things. And so that's at the core of what we do.
Thank you to BND President Todd Steinwan for those closing words and to everyone that participated in this piece.
And we want to say thanks to our intern, Nick Rommel, for putting together that piece on the State Bank of North Dakota. He joins me now in studio. Nick, welcome to Main Street. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's it's exciting to you know, talk live on Main Street for the first time.
That was a really fun piece. And honestly, for me to be a journalist of some years at this point, to be seeing fresh people still interested in radio storing, it's the kind of thing that gives me hope for the future of what we're doing. So thanks for wanting to do that. What made you interested in an internship in public radio, because you're not even studying journalism?
No, my college doesn't have a journalism program, so I'm a history major.
And that's at the University of Chicago?
Yep. But I got interested because I kind of decided slash realized I wanted to be a journalist or writer of some sort. But at the time I was applying to internships last winter, I hadn't really had any experience in print, to be honest. And I had a radio show at my college, and I still do. So I kind of applied to radio stations instead. And yeah.
And is it like this? Is it storytelling, production pieces?
No.
Do you have my job on your show?
No, I have Mike Olson's job.
Okay, so it's radio.
So
it's music.
Yeah, I do like music for an hour and a half, but I try to talk as much as possible. So, yeah.
You're a musician yourself too, right?
I am also a musician, yeah.
Okay, what do you play?
Guitar, piano, and banjo, and accordion, I guess.
And accordion?
Yeah.
Can you do those all at once?
No. I can do only one at once.
What brought you to North Dakota? You're from the East Coast. You're studying at a prestigious university in Chicago. And mm-hmm. here you are in Fargo for the summer.
Yeah, well, I've always considered myself someone that doesn't, you know, think too much about, like, that tries to have the best experience possible and not just, like, go to the biggest names possible. Hmm. So I was looking at, like, internships at the national NPR headquarters and, you know, I mean, I'm sure that'd have been great, but they had some internships where, like, my only job would have just been booking interviews for other people for, like, the entire summer. So I thought I wanted to go somewhere where I'd have more responsibilities and kind of could take the bull by the horns. I think I said that correctly. So I looked at, like, the NPR.
Not a lot of bulls in Boston.
Yeah, that's true. I looked at all the smallest states. So, like, I looked at Alaska and Mississippi and stuff, but then North Dakota had the best internships, so.
Okay. Well, give us, you know, your sense of the state. We were in a Zoom meeting earlier this week, and we had all made some reference to a song that we all knew by virtue of growing up here. And you made a comment about how you're going to miss Midwest culture. So to somebody who's not steeped in Midwest, what is Midwestern culture?
Well, for one, like, I was surprised that even in a city like Fargo, on the streets, people look you in the eye and give you a nod or say hello, which is, I mean, in Chicago, they definitely don't. In Boston, they definitely don't. I mean, they do in small towns all over the country, but I've never seen that in a city. Besides,
New Orleans will do that.
Okay. Well, I guess I haven't been there. So, another couple other things is I noticed a couple times I went to the movies here, and in general, I feel like the benchmark for, like, laughing at something is lower than it is in other parts of the country. Like, I hear way more laughs.
I'm trying not to laugh at that.
I hear way more laughs in the movies here than I have anywhere else. And I kind of laugh along then. And I feel less self-conscious laughing. So there's that. And then I like the big open spaces. And kind of as soon as you leave town, it's just, you know, because in Boston, where I grew up, it's like you leave town and it's just suburbs for hours.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, it's like as soon as you're out of town, it's like you're out of town. So.
Did you get to travel the region a bit?
I did. I tried to do that as much as possible. So I did day trips to do interviews in Hankinson, Jamestown, Devil's Lake, went around Fargo itself a bit. And then my friend came up. We did a road trip through the Badlands and then Montana, Wyoming, and South Dakota.
Oh, wow.
So that was quite a big trip. And then this past week, I went for 3 days up to Rolla and Turtle Mountain area to work on two stories. So I think I got to see a pretty good sampling of different areas in North Dakota.
Yeah, that's lovely. And what will you do with this internship?
Well, my major is not journalism, so I guess it doesn't relate to that. But I have a lot of ideas for things I can do with my radio show in college. I think I'll stick to the sort of live music DJing format, but I think I'm going to incorporate more pre-produced things, like more narration maybe that I prepare beforehand to tell stories around the songs I'm playing and maybe even go away from the songs a little, maybe turn it into a podcast so I can post it online.
Yeah.
I write for the school newspaper, so, I mean, that's not radio, but I'm definitely going to, like, use the interview skills that I learned here to do that better.
And maybe you can even be composing your own music on the accordion, piano.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't really thought of that.
For your podcast?
Yeah.
Now, you traveled with your guitar, right? And
I
you
did.
Ended up buying a bike here?
Yeah.
Okay, so when you hit the road, like, you are you become a temporary citizen of wherever you're going.
I guess so. And that became a problem because I was going to take it, lug it all back on the Amtrak with me to Chicago, but the Amtrak got canceled. So luckily I acquired a plane ticket to replace it, but I think that means I'm going to have to pawn off my bike.
Oh no.
Or leave it here. Just too bad.
Well, there are a lot of bike riders at Prairie Public. It'll probably get ridden. So.
Yeah, I noticed. Public radio and bicycles seem like a pretty natural combination.
And gardening and coffee. And yeah. All right. Well, Prairie Public intern Nick Rommel on his summer living in Fargo and exploring the great state of North Dakota. Thanks so much for joining us today. We hope to hear more from you in the future.
Thank you. I hope to hear more from myself, too.
Still to come on Main Street, an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show about the book Occupied America, British Military Rule and the Experience of Revolution. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A retired North Dakota Highway Patrol officer says inexperience among younger law enforcement officers may be a factor in some of the recent officer-involved shootings. Ed Grichala was the sergeant in the patrol's Fargo district when he retired after 25 years.
Law enforcement is no different than any other profession nowadays. There's a lot of people that have retired. You lost a lot of seasoned guys. You've got a lot of young people on the streets. I think when I was a rookie, I reacted differently. Hadn't been in a lot of serious situations and probably maybe may have overreacted when I was younger. But as you get some time on it and learn people's behavior and what to look for, maybe you become a little more cautious.
Grichala says while growth in a community is good, it also has negative consequences. He's a former state representative who served a North Fargo district. Five Fargo police officers and a state trooper are on paid administrative leave while the State Crime Bureau investigates whether use of force was justified. Minnesota's electric grid will get a $2 billion upgrade. That's part of a $10 billion grid expansion in the Midwest, approved by the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. Minnesota project locations will be in Alexandria, Benton County, and Rochester. Minnesota Department of Commerce Commissioner Grace Arnold says the investment will lead to more reliability and jobs, and she says it will also relieve congestion in the grid, which has slowed the growth of renewable energy.
We want to recognize that there are wind projects in southern Minnesota that have been curtailed because of the transmission line congestion. Local renewable development projects in solar have been put on hold because there isn't enough capacity in these lines to get those energy resources into the market.
Construction will take years. And the manager of the Bismarck Airport says expansion plans could soon be in the works. Greg Haug says in 2019 he was working on hiring a consultant to student the airport's needs and make plans for upgrades.
And then COVID hit and we didn't continue that at that time.
Haug says that boardings are coming back, especially among leisure travelers. Then the timing seems right.
We are in the throes of right now of negotiating an agreement to do that study.
Haug says the need is there for expansion.
In 2019, we had as many as six planes that would come in at night, sit on the ground, and remain overnight. We have four gates, but yet we still had six planes on the ground overnight. When we had several of the mainline aircraft, operating, close to each other throughout the day, boarding area got pretty full.
Haug says the expansion could include more gates, a bigger boarding area, and another baggage claim carousel. He says the study will likely take a year to complete, and after that, he would be working with the Bismarck City Commission to come up with a financing plan. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Otto Bremer Trust, investing in people, places, and opportunities in North Dakota, Montana, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Learn more at ottobremer.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we are going to share an excerpt now from the Prairie Pulse television show with Donald Johnson, an associate professor of history at North Dakota State University. He has been studying the British occupation of America, and that research led to a book called Occupied America, British Military Rule and the Experience of Revolution. The book chronicles the everyday experience of ordinary people living under military occupation during the American Revolution. Here's an excerpt from Dr. Johnson's conversation with Prairie Pulse host John Harris.
Dr. Johnson, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to your book, tell the folks a little bit about yourself, maybe your background, where you're originally from.
Sure. I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. In Maryland, and I did my graduate training at Northwestern University in Chicago. And I've been here at in Fargo and at NDSU for almost 8 years now.
Your specialty being colonial America. Was that what sparked your interest in that, was being growing up around D.C. And all that?
Yeah, I mean, first growing up around D.C. and then specifically kind of on the book, which is about military occupation in the American Revolution. I started writing it in graduate school, and it was around the time of kind of the height of the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan in the United States. And it kind of got me thinking about different circumstances and the ways that different populations react to civil wars and revolutionary movements and hostile military occupations. And it just got me thinking kind of as I read more and more about the revolutionary time period, no one had really studied exactly what happened with the British military occupations, at least in a systemic way. And so I wanted to kind of look at how the experience of military occupation during the 8 years of war, 1775 through 1783, and how that kind of shaped Americans' political consciousness and changed their opinions in both directions about the British Empire and the revolutionary movement.
So what really led the American Revolution, and what did Great Britain specifically do to sort of alienate the colonists?
The simple answer is taxation. That's kind of the textbook answer, right, is the idea that there were taxes levied on the colonists by Great Britain, specifically by the Parliament, which was seeking to kind of recoup some war debt from a previous struggle, the French and Indian War. And you know, the simplest answer is that American colonists resented these taxes, kind of remonstrated against them for about a decade, and when peaceful measures didn't work, they resorted to kind of more radical ideas, eventually armed protest and rebellion. The more complicated story is how the colonies fit into the British Empire more generally. The British Empire was founded on an idea, and you know, we kind of think of this as a little bit counterintuitive today, where we think of the revolution as this struggle of liberalism or republicanism against a tyrannical empire. In fact, in the 18th century, Great Britain and the British Empire was one of the freest societies on earth. It was governed ever since 1688 by a constitutional monarchy, one that still stands today. And the problem was representation. The problem was that Parliament was levying taxes like the Stamp Act, the Sugar Act, the Townshend duties, and eventually the tea tax, without going through what many colonists saw as proper constitutional channels. The idea being that under the British system, Parliament could only levy taxes if people were represented in that body. And Americans, you know, did not have representation in Parliament. And so a lot of the arguments, you know, and we kind of tend to simplify this as American colonists saying, you know, well, we don't want to pay any taxes. What you actually see from a lot of, especially the early revolutionary leaders, is arguments that says, you know, we're willing to pay these taxes. We're willing to, you know, do whatever we need to do to contribute to the upkeep of the empire. But we want to do it in ways that are decided by our legislators. So essentially they're saying, you know, send us the bill and we'll figure out how to pay it, but don't kind of impose these duties and taxes on us externally.
Well, can you talk a little bit about, you know, not everybody was for the revolution. So some of the colonists obviously probably wanted to remain with Britain.
Absolutely. I mean, the classic estimate is John Adams wrote in 1776 that around a third of the population was gung-ho for independence or for revolution. About a third of the population could swing either way. And then about a third of the population was fundamentally loyalist. wanted to remain with Great Britain. A lot of these people were folks whose livelihoods depended on the empire. What became the United States was an integral part of a transatlantic and even kind of worldwide British economy. There were goods, you know, transshipped from New York that came from India, that came from China, that came from South America and the Caribbean, as well as from Europe. And a lot of the people, especially in port cities and especially kind of those with mercantile interests, were very invested in that and worried that independence or a prolonged rebellion would interrupt those trade links and that kind of economic prosperity. The other main element of it was, and more historians are demonstrating now, was kind of a cultural and religious aspect. A large proportion of colonial Americans were Anglicans, and the head of the Anglican Church is the king or queen of England. And so many of them saw kind of a rebellion against the monarch as kind of a rebellion against the head of their church and against their religious faith. And then, yeah, finally, the American colonists, you know, even up through 1775, 1776, saw themselves as fundamentally British kind of culturally as well as politically, and many didn't want to give up that link to the mother country.
Yeah. And, of course, still intrigued with royalty as they're doing today.
Exactly.
Right. You know, talk about the Declaration of Independence just a little
sure.
bit. You know, why the importance of it, even though Britain still occupied America at the time?
Yeah, I mean, and the importance is kind of because there were British troops and a lot of British power remaining in North America. So the revolution actually, you know, it begins early in 1775, you know, over a year before the Declaration of Independence is actually ratified by the Continental Congress. It begins kind of with these sporadic regional battles. Lexington and Concord in April of 1775 is kind of the big one. But there's also skirmishes in Virginia and South Carolina and New Hampshire, New York City, and everywhere. And for about a year, it was nearly a local affair. The Continental Congress existed and you know, was trying to coordinate things and certainly built up institutions like the Continental Army, which is formed in the summer of 1775. But there was no clear kind of unified resistance, at least at the kind of intercolonial level. What there was were local revolutionary committees and statewide, or at the time kind of colony-wide, congresses and conventions that were kind of governing local areas and beginning to remove British officials from power. But there needed to be kind of a larger coordinating effort from above. The other part of it was there needed to be a state. You know, the British colonies in rebellion didn't have as much standing as they would as an independent country. And so in order to seek help, for example, from potentially friendly powers like France and Spain and Russia and the Netherlands, the Continental Congress decided that they needed to define kind of their own agenda as a nation-building project, as kind of an independent nation, which would make it easier kind of diplomatically for these other countries, which were rivals of Great Britain and were anxious to kind of put a stick in their eye, that the United States was actually kind of a country and that it wouldn't go on and kind of just go back to Great Britain once the war was done.
Yeah. And with that, how did the colonial army defeat Britain? Of course, when you think about it, they had to be the underdog and would think that they didn't have the superior military strength.
They absolutely did not. You know, and at no point in the war did the Continental Army or colonial forces ever have, you know, either a numerical or certainly a training advantage over the British Army. The British Army coming out of the French and Indian War was one of the, if not the most fearsome fighting force in the world. What the revolutionaries were able to do was adopt a very specific strategy of avoiding major battles. It's what military historians call kind of a Fabian strategy, where essentially the goal is to keep the army as intact as possible and in the field. And the idea being that the British army, which was 1,000 miles from home, undersupplied, increasingly unable to get food and provisions in North America, would eventually kind of get tired of the fight and sue for peace. The other aspect of it was diplomatic, in kind of two folds. One was aimed at Great Britain, the idea that if they could show that the army couldn't necessarily outright defeat the British army, but could cause them enough headaches, then Parliament, which already had a number of people sympathetic to the American cause in it, would eventually kind of force King George to stop the war and negotiate a settlement. And the other diplomatic angle being with those other countries, with France and Spain and the Netherlands especially, but especially with France, who was the other kind of major empire, major European empire of the period. And it was a lot of kind of deft diplomacy by Benjamin Franklin and John Adams and others, along with kind of a crucial military victory at Saratoga, which brought the French into the war. And that not only added troop strength to the North American theater, but it made Britain defend its empire all across the world. And so the French began striking British Caribbean islands. They began prepping for an invasion of Ireland and potentially an invasion of Britain itself. And so it forced Britain to kind of reconsider the conflict, not just as suppressing a rebellion, but as fighting kind of a worldwide imperial war in addition to the Continental Army.
Yeah. And, you know, most people know about Washington, Jefferson, Madison. You mentioned Franklin and Adams. But who are some of the other key figures who helped shape this young nation?
Sure. I think names that people might know but not know why are people like John Dickinson. It's hard to overstate his importance, especially in the early periods of the Revolution. In the 1760s, under a pseudonym of the Pennsylvania Farmer, he wrote several kind of widely published tracts repudiating Parliament's right to tax the colonies without representation and proposing a kind of negotiated solution, a kind of Atlantic Parliament or representation for the colonies. He also drafted at the very last moment in 1775 what we now call the Olive Branch Petition, which was essentially a document the Continental Congress sent to George III, listing their demands and saying kind of, you know, we're willing to have peace, but if we don't hear something from you, if we don't, you know, have any movement on Parliament's end, we're going to go to war. Another figure that I think deserves a lot more recognition, especially nowadays, is George Mason. Mason was a Virginian, a planter, a neighbor of George Washington, a prominent lawyer. He had a hand in drafting Virginia's first constitution, but his main contribution was the Virginia Declaration of Rights, and it was the first kind of articulation of fundamental rights that were guaranteed to Americans and to all humankind. This is in kind of late 75, early 76. So I'd say, I'd say Dickinson, Mason, and a lot of these early revolutionaries. The third and final name I'll mention is Samuel Adams. You know, we tend to think of him as just kind of a guy on a beer bottle now, and actually it's Paul Revere on the beer bottle. It's not even Samuel Adams. But he was crucial in organizing the resistance in Boston. He was the mastermind of the Boston Tea Party and a lot of that kind of early resistance that spurred the colonists to armed resistance. In fact, one of the factors that caused the outbreak of violence at Lexington and Concord was an order to arrest Samuel Adams and his co-conspirator John Hancock in April of 1775 that sent troops out to Concord.
Yeah. You know, despite various interpretations and the addition of amendments, how or why has the Constitution survived over 200 years?
I think really because of its flexibility. You know, it allows different states to govern, for the most part, kind of based on the interests of their population. You know, aside from the Bill of Rights and future amendments, it doesn't really spell out doctrinaire things or kind of how states or counties or towns or even anything should be run. It guarantees each state a Republican form of government. It guarantees representation of free people, and this is amended in the Civil War to include all people and to abolish slavery. And it creates this framework by which there's a strong national government which can pursue things like defense of the country, diplomacy, internal policing and taxation, but also which leaves certain elements to local governments. And I think, you know, it's kind of that sweet spot between kind of the British system, which is that kind of overarching parliament, and kind of what the Americans were fighting for in the Revolution, which was more local autonomy, more freedom for kind of local towns and counties and states.
You know, I know you teach some courses. Do you find students are interested in the time period, or they not know much about it when they come to class?
Both. You know, my class on Revolutionary America is consistently the best enrolled of any of the classes I teach. This past year, I actually had a waiting list for the first time on that. And it's one of the classes that gets the most diverse student body. I mean, most of my classes, it's a lot of history majors, education majors, you know, people who are pursuing this field. And in my revolution class, it's a lot of people from all angles of the university, right? We got engineering, business, ag, people like that. So I find there's tremendous interest, but the students don't come in with a very clear picture. They come in knowing certain things about the Founding Fathers. They know, you know, maybe a couple of battles in the Revolution. They might have read about George Washington or Benjamin Franklin or watched some of the excellent kind of PBS documentaries that are out about these things. And I find that they end up surprised by just how messy the time period was and how complex it was.
Well, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
That was Prairie Pulse host John Harris visiting with NDSU Associate Professor of History, Dr. Donald Johnson, about his book, Occupied America, British Military Rule and the Experience of Revolution. Prairie Pulse airs Thursdays at 8 o'clock Central. And this week, John is visiting with Dr. Terry Hogan, Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for the City of Fargo. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota United, an organization of over 11,000 education and public employees serving the public every step of the way. Information available at ndunited.org.
Visit the world's strangest museums.
They basically go to great lengths to select the worst bad art possible.
The Greek mainland.
It's so rugged and individual, and I think the people there rather reflect their surroundings.
And see how mythology lives on today.
And I went looking for beauty and hope. Those things are all over the Greek landscape.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
The
This is Dakota Datebook for August 3rd. 5,000 Indians of the Sioux Nation gathered in 1888 for discussions on a treaty that would open up land in the Standing Rock Reservation for non-native settlement. The government was represented by three commissioners who needed three-quarters of all adult Lakota males to approve the treaty. Today marked the 11th day of discussions, and the commissioners had yet to gather a single signature. Five leaders represented the tribe. They were Chiefs Gall, John Grass, Mad Bear, Big Head, and Running Antelope. The treaty would open up half the reservation for settlement, 11 million acres. The land would be purchased for $1 million and sold for 50 cents per acre, with 5% credited to the tribe. Mad Bear said, quote, "If you sign this paper giving away your lands, you can never get it back again. No matter how much you pray, it will be gone forever," end quote. Official proceedings had begun July 24th, and the entire day was spent taking roll. Many Native Americans refused to even view the circulars explaining the treaty, and on the 27th, a formal expression of disapproval was given. Chief Grass stated, "You tell us 11 million of acres of our land is to be given to the whites, and we are to get 50 cents for every acre sold. $1 million is to be advanced to us, and we are to get 5% of that for ourselves. One half of this is to be used for industrial schools, and we are to get the other half. This would give us about $1 each." That was a line which brought laughter. "We do not think this would make us very rich." The frustrated commissioners continued to try and convince the tribes to sign, but to no avail. On August 3rd, the commissioners began threatening to condemn the land, but the Sioux stood their ground. They argued that the government had failed to live up to past treaties and the price was not enough. On August 7th, John Grass told the commissioners that they would sign no paper for or against the treaty and would leave. The tribe left peacefully and victorious. The commissioners had failed in this first attempt to open the Standing Rock Reservation for white settlement. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Tessa Sandstrom. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban is speaking at CPAC this week, not long after delivering a speech in Europe that's been called a Nazi diatribe.
He's fighting for an old white world or old white Europe where men were men and women were women.
Why Orban's visit to the U.S. is welcomed by some and criticized by others. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Laurel Reuter, the longtime director of the North Dakota Museum of Art, has retired, and she visits with Director of Radio Bill Thomas about her career. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.